This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, the triumphant, turbulent stories behind how video games are made by Jason Schreier. Read by Ray Chase. Introduction. Say you want to make a video game. You've got this killer idea. It's about a mustachioed plumber who has to rescue his princess girlfriend from a giant fire-breathing turtle, and you've convinced an investor to give you a few million dollars to make it happen. Now what? Well, first you need to figure out the exact number of people you can afford to hire. Then you need to call up some artists, some designers, some programmers. You'll need a producer to keep things running smoothly and a sound department to make sure the game has, you know, sounds. Can't forget to hire some quality assurance testers to check for bugs, and a marketing savant. How else will everyone know about your future bestseller? Once you're all staffed up, you'll need to make a strict schedule that determines how much time your team will spend on each part of the game. If all goes well, you'll develop a demo for E3 in 6 months, then be feature complete by the end of the year. After a few months, things seem to be going well. Your artists are drawing all sorts of cool enemies for your plumber to fight. Ghosts, mushrooms, that sort of thing. The designers have sketched out some clever levels that will guide the player through raging volcanoes and fetid swamps. The programmers just figured out a fancy rendering trick that will make the dungeons look more realistic than anything you've seen before. Everyone is motivated, the game is making progress, and you're handing out stock options like they're free newspapers in the subway. One morning, you get a call from your producer. Turns out that rendering trick is useless because it knocks your game's frame rate down to 10 frames per second. A game's frame rate is the frequency at which images are displayed on the screen. Our eyes are trained to play games at a baseline rate of 30 frames per second. When the frame rate dips lower than that, everything in the game starts to look choppy, as if it's being run on an old projector. The playtesters keep getting stuck on the volcano level. And your marketing guy is grumbling about how that might affect your Metacritic score. Your art director insists on micromanaging the animators, which is driving them crazy. Your E3 demo is due in 2 weeks, and you know there's no way you can get it done in less than 4. And suddenly, the investors are asking if maybe you can slash that $10 million budget down to $8 million, even if you have to let go of a few people to make that happen. A week ago, you were fantasizing about the speech you'd make at the Game Awards after taking home Game of the Year. Now you're wondering if you'll ever even finish. I once had drinks with a developer who just shipped a new game. He looked exhausted. He and his team had been right near the goal line, he said, when they were hit with a revelation. One of the game's biggest features wasn't actually fun to play. The developer's team had to spend the next few months crunching, working 80 to 100-hour weeks to scrap the feature and overhaul everything they had done to that point. Some of them slept in the office so they wouldn't have to waste time commuting, because every hour spent in the car was an hour not spent fixing bugs. Up until the day they had to submit a final build, many of them doubted they'd be able to release the game at all. "It sounds like a miracle that this game was even made," I said. "Oh, Jason," he said. "It's a miracle that any game is made." In the years I've been reporting on the world of video games, that's been a common theme. Developers everywhere, whether at tiny independent studios or publicly traded corporations, talk frequently about how difficult it is to design and produce games. Walk into any San Francisco bar during the annual Game Developers Conference, GDC, and you're bound to find groups of weary designers trying to one-up each other with stories of coding binges and caffeine-fueled all-nighters. War metaphors are common. Tales from the trenches is a ubiquitous expression, as are choruses of complaints that the outside world doesn't get it. One surefire way to annoy a game developer is to ask, in response to discovering his or her chosen career path, what it's like to spend all day playing video games. But even if you accept the premise that video game development is grueling work, it's not easy for those of us on the outside to see why. People have been making games since the 1970s, haven't they? With decades of lessons and experience to draw from, shouldn't game development have grown more efficient? Maybe it made sense for developers to crunch in the late 1980s, when gaming was the domain of teens and 20-somethings who gorged on pizza and Diet Coke as they coded all night and slept all day. But decades later, video games fueled a $30 billion industry in the United States alone. Why do game developers still have so many stories about staying at the office until 3 a.m.? Why is it still so difficult to make video games? To try to answer these questions, I went out and engaged in my favorite activity, bothering people who know way more than I do. I spoke to around 100 game developers and executives, both on and off the record, asking them an endless number of nosy questions about their lives, their jobs, and why they sacrifice so much to make video games. There are 10 chapters in this book, each telling the story behind how a different video game was made. One chapter visits Irvine, California, for a look at how the Kickstarter-funded Pillars of Eternity helped Obsidian Entertainment recover from its darkest days. Another chapter heads to Seattle, Washington, where the 20-something Eric Barone shut himself alone in a room for nearly 5 years to create a serene farming game called Stardew Valley. Other chapters tell stories about Dragon Age Inquisition's technological nightmare, Uncharted 4's brutal time crunch, and even the mystery behind LucasArts' much-hyped Star Wars 1313. As you listen, many of these stories may strike you as anomalous. Games that were hampered by drastic technology changes, directorial shifts, or other wild factors beyond the developer's control. It's tempting to think, while hearing these stories, that these games were all made under abnormal sets of circumstances. That these people were just unlucky. That the developers of these games might have averted hardship if they had followed industry standards and avoided common pitfalls, or if they had made smarter decisions from the get-go. Here's an alternative theory. Every single video game is made under abnormal circumstances. Video games straddle the border between art and technology in a way that was barely possible just a few decades ago. Combine technological shifts with the fact that a video game can be just about anything, from a two-dimensional iPhone puzzler to a massive open-world RPG with uber-realistic graphics, and it shouldn't be too shocking to discover that there are no uniform standards for how games are made. Lots of video games look the same, but no two video games are created the same way, which is a pattern you'll see throughout this book. But why is it so hard to make them? If, like me, you have never tried to develop a commercial video game before, you might find it helpful to review a few possible theories. 1. They're interactive. Video games don't move in a single linear direction. Unlike, say, a computer-generated Pixar movie, games run on real-time graphics, in which new images are generated by the computer every millisecond. Video games, unlike Toy Story, need to react to the player's actions. As you play a video game, your PC or console or phone or calculator renders characters and scenes on the fly based on your decisions. If you choose to walk into a room, the game needs to load up all the furniture. If you choose to save and quit, the game needs to store your data. If you choose to murder the helpful robot, the game needs to identify A, whether it's possible to kill the robot, B, whether you're powerful enough to kill the robot, and C, what kind of awful sounds the robot will make as you spill its metallic guts. Then the game might have to remember your actions, so other characters know that you're a heartless murderer and can say things like, "Hey, you're that heartless murderer!" 2. Technology is constantly changing. As computers evolve, which happens without fail every year, graphic processing gets more powerful. And as graphic processing gets more powerful, we expect prettier games. As Fergus Urquhart, the CEO of Obsidian, told me, "We are on the absolute edge of technology. We are always pushing everything, all the time." Urquhart pointed out that making games is sort of like shooting movies if you had to build an entirely new camera every time you started. That's a common analogy. Another is that making a game is like constructing a building during an earthquake, or trying to drive a train while someone else runs in front of you, laying down track as you go. 3. The tools are always different. To make games, artists and designers need to work with all sorts of software, ranging from common programs like Photoshop and Maya, to proprietary apps that vary from studio to studio. Like technology, these tools are constantly evolving based on developers' needs and ambitions. If a tool runs too slowly, is full of bugs, or is missing pivotal features, making games can be excruciating. While most people seem to think that game development is about having great ideas, It's really more about the skill of taking great ideas from paper to product, a developer once told me. You need a good engine and toolset to do this. 4. Scheduling is impossible. The unpredictability is what makes it challenging, said Chris Rippey, a veteran producer who worked on Halo Wars. In game development, a producer's job is to coordinate schedules, wrangle the rest of the team, and ensure that everyone is on the same page. As Ryan Treadwell, a veteran producer, once told me, we're the people who are responsible for making sure that a product gets made. In traditional software development, Rippey explained, you can set up a reliable schedule based on how long tasks have taken in the past. But with games, Rippey said, you're talking about where is it fun? How long does fun take? Did you achieve that? Did you achieve enough fun? You're literally talking about a piece of art for the artist. When is that piece of art done? If he spends another day on it, would that have made all the difference in the world to the game? Where do you stop? That's the trickiest part. Eventually, you do get into the production-y side of things. You've proven the fun. You've proven the look of the game, and now it becomes more predictable. But it's a real journey in the dark up until that point. Which leads us to 5. It's impossible to know how fun a game will be until you've played it. You can take educated guesses, sure, but until you've got your hands on a controller, there's no way to tell whether it feels good to move, jump, and bash your robot pal's brains out with a sledgehammer. Even for very, very experienced game designers, it's really scary, said Amelia Schatz, a designer at Naughty Dog. The role of a designer can vary from studio to studio, but in general, it's a designer's job to make decisions about how a game will function. These decisions range from major, what kind of weapons will the player use, to minor, how will the game distinguish between doors that the player can open and doors that just stay locked. All of us throw out so much work because we create a bunch of stuff and it plays terribly. You make these intricate plans in your head about how well things are going to work, and then when it actually comes and you try to play it, it's terrible. In all the stories in this book, you'll see several common themes. Every game is delayed at least once. Every game developer must make tough compromises. Every company must sweat over which hardware and technology to use. Every studio must build its schedules around big trade shows like E3, where developers will draw motivation and even feedback from throngs of excited fans. And most controversially, everyone who makes video games has to crunch, sacrificing personal lives and family time for a job that seems to never end. Yet many of the people who make video games say they can't imagine doing anything else. When they describe that feeling of being on the cutting edge of technology, of building interactive entertainment that's unlike any other medium, of working with a team of dozens or even hundreds to create something that millions of people might play, it all adds up to an unshakable belief that for all the turbulence, for all the crunch, for all the unadulterated bullshit that developers often have to go through, making video games is worth it. So about your plumber game, Super Plumber Adventure. It turns out there are solutions to all your problems, though you might not like them. You can cut your budget by outsourcing some of the animation work to a studio in New Jersey. It might not look as good, but it'll be half the price. You can ask the level designers to add some extra platforms to the volcano level so it's a little less punishing. When they object, to remind them that, hey, not everybody loves Dark Souls. And you can tell the art director that the programmers have their own jobs to do and really don't need to hear his opinions on chiaroscuro in video games. Hitting that E3 deadline might be a little tougher, but what if you ask your employees to stay late for a couple of weeks? No more than 2 weeks, of course. To make up for it, you'll buy them dinner and maybe even offer them nice bonuses if the game gets a 90 on Metacritic. You'll also have to cut out a few features. Sorry, I know, they were awesome. But it's not like your plumber really needs to transform into a raccoon. You can save that for the sequel. Reporting note. The stories in this book are based on interviews I conducted with roughly 100 game developers and other industry figures between 2015 and 2017. Most of those people spoke on the record. Others spoke on background, requesting anonymity because they were not authorized to participate in this book and did not want to risk damaging their careers. You'll probably notice that most of the people who speak in this book are male, which is a depressing and unintentional reflection of an industry that has, for decades now, been dominated by men. Except when otherwise noted, anything you see in quotation marks was said to me directly. This book does not contain recreated dialogue. All the anecdotes and details in this book come directly from the accounts of sources, and all were corroborated by at least two people whenever possible. Some of this reporting was based on trips to studios and homes in Los Angeles, Irvine, Seattle, Edmonton, and Warsaw. I paid for my own travel and did not accept accommodations from any companies or developers, although I did say yes to a few lunches, which seemed kosher. But the lunches weren't kosher. What I mean is that it seemed ethically acceptable. You know what? Let's just get on with the book. Chapter 1. Pillars of Eternity. The most important question in video game development has nothing to do with making video games. It's a simple question that has stymied artists for centuries and put an end to countless creative endeavors. How are we going to pay for this thing? In early 2012, Fergus Urquhart, the CEO of Obsidian Entertainment, found himself unable to come up with an answer. Obsidian, a relatively small game development studio based in Irvine, California, had spent the past year working on a fantasy role-playing game, RPG, called Stormlands. They'd never made a game quite like this. It was weird, ambitious, and most important, funded by Microsoft, whose game producers had decided they wanted a massive, exclusive RPG to launch alongside their next console, the Xbox One. Around 50 of Obsidian's approximately 115 employees were working on the game, which meant it cost a lot of money, which was fine, as long as Microsoft kept sending checks. Urquhart had grown accustomed to financial pressure. He'd been working in games since 1991, first as a tester at the publisher Interplay, then as a designer, then as the boss of the powerhouse developer Black Isle Studios, which a suddenly cash-strapped Interplay dismantled in 2003. That same year, Urquhart founded Obsidian with a few other Black Isle veterans, and they quickly learned that running an independent studio was like juggling dangerous objects. If they didn't have a new contract ready to go as soon as the last one had finished, they were in trouble. Urquhart has thin, light brown hair and a stocky build. He speaks quickly, with the authoritative tone of someone who spent decades pitching games. Over the years, he's played a part in creating some of the most beloved RPGs in gaming, like Fallout and Baldur's Gate. While speaking on panels and to the press, he's always candid about the difficulties of running an indie studio. The life of an independent developer is every morning you wake up wondering if your publishers are going to call and cancel your games, Urquhart said. I wish I was more of a sociopath or psychopath and I could just completely ignore the fact that there's this guillotine pointed at my neck all the time. But I can't. And I don't think a lot of developers can. And unfortunately, there's that constant threat, and that threat is used a lot. It's used all the time. On the morning of March 12, 2012, Urquhart's cell lit up. It was the Stormlands producer at Microsoft, texting to ask if Urquhart could hop on the phone. Right away, he knew what was about to happen. "It's the text from the girlfriend who's going to break up with you," Urquhart said. "I just got on the call knowing what it was going to be." Microsoft's representative was frank. They were canceling Stormlands. Effective immediately, 50 of Urquhart's employees no longer had work. The producer didn't say why Microsoft was axing the game, but it had become clear to Obsidian's top staff that development was not going smoothly. There was an inordinate amount of pressure, not just to make a good RPG, but to make a good RPG that could sell Xbox Ones. Stormlands' ideas had felt disjointed to Obsidian staff, and, at least from Obsidian's point of view, Microsoft's expectations were impractical. As some former Stormlands developers described it, the game was full of ambitious, high-level ideas, many driven by Microsoft's vision of what should be in an Xbox One launch game. The Xbox One was all about the Kinect, a motion-sensing camera that could recognize full-body gestures. So, what if Stormlands let you use Kinect to haggle with shopkeepers? The Xbox One would support cloud computing, allowing each player's console to interact with Microsoft-owned computer servers. So, what if Stormlands had big, massively multiplayer raids that would let you meet up with other players on the fly? These ideas all sounded interesting on paper, but it was unclear whether any of them would work in a game. Different people who worked on the game pointed different reasons for Stormlands' ultimate demise. Some say Microsoft was too ambitious. Others say Obsidian was too petulant. But everyone agrees that by the end, the project had gotten unwieldy. Expectation after expectation after expectation got piled onto the game, Urquhart said. It turned into this thing that everybody was scared of. I think, in fact, even we were scared of it. Urquhart hung up the phone, trying to figure out what this would mean for his company. The standard burn rate for a game studio was $10,000 per person per month, a number that included both salaries and overhead costs, like health insurance and office rent. Using that number as a baseline, keeping all 50 Stormlands developers employed would cost the studio at least $500,000 every month. By Urquhart's count, Obsidian had already put $2 million of its own money into Stormlands on top of what it had received from Microsoft, and the company didn't have much left to spare. With only one other game in development, South Park, The Stick of Truth, which was having its own financial crisis thanks to the slow meltdown of its publisher THQ, Obsidian just didn't have the cash to keep all those people employed. THQ stopped operating 9 months later, in December 2012, selling off all its projects in a bankruptcy auction the following month. South Park, The Stick of Truth went to the French publisher Ubisoft. Fergus Urquhart gathered Obsidian's other four owners and went to a Starbucks down the road, where they spent hours huddling over a big list of names, trying to figure out whom to keep and whom to let go. The next day, Urquhart called an all-hands meeting. "It started out fine," said Dimitri Berman, a lead character artist. "People were joking around." Then Fergus came out all dead-looking. Choking back tears, Urquhart told the company that Microsoft had canceled Stormlands and that Obsidian would have to lay people off. The staff trickled back to their desks, wondering which of them were about to be escorted out of the building. For hours, they all just had to wait there, nervously watching as Obsidian's operations guy prepared severance packages for those who hadn't made the cut. "He comes around with a manila folder and he walks around and he tells you to pack your bags," said Adam Brennecke, a programmer on Stormlands. "And he escorts you off the premises and he sets up a time when you can come back and get your belongings. He's just walking around and you're thinking, 'Don't come into my office, don't come into my office.' You're watching him and then you see and you're like, 'Fuck, there goes one of my friends.'" By the end of the day, the company had been gutted. Obsidian laid off around 26 of the people who had worked on Stormlands, including one engineer who had been hired just a day earlier. These weren't incompetent or inadequate employees. They were beloved co-workers. "It was fucking terrible," said Josh Sawyer, the director of Stormlands. "It was horrible. It was probably the worst day of my career. It was the biggest layoff I had ever seen." Since 2003, Obsidian had survived as an independent studio, bouncing from contract to contract as its staff took freelance work to keep the lights on. The company had been through brutal cancellations before, like Aliens Crucible, a Sega-published RPG whose demise also led to big layoffs. But none had hurt this much. None had left Fergus Urquhart with so few options. After nearly 10 years, those remaining at Obsidian were starting to wonder, was this the end? 400 miles north, as Urquhart and his crew tried to recover from catastrophe, the staff of Double Fine were popping champagne. Double Fine, an independent studio in San Francisco led by the illustrious designer Tim Schafer, had just found a way to revolutionize the video game industry. For decades, the video game industry's power balance had been simple. Developers made games. Publishers paid for them. Although there were always exceptions, venture capitalists, lottery winners, and so on, the bulk of video game development was funded by big publishers with deep pockets. Publishers almost always had the leverage in these negotiations, which could lead developers to agree to some rigid deals. For the role-playing game Fallout New Vegas, for example, the publisher, Bethesda, offered Obsidian a $1 million bonus if the game hit an 85 out of 100 on Metacritic, a website that aggregates review scores from across the internet. As the reviews started pouring in, the Metacritic number swung up and down several times before finally settling at 84. Obsidian did not get its bonus. Traditionally, independent studios like Obsidian and Double Fine had three ways to stay afloat. One, finding investors. Two, signing contracts with publishers to make games. Or three, funding their own video games with war chests they'd hoarded via options 1 and 2. No decent-sized indie studio could survive without relying at least partly on money from outside partners, even if that meant dealing with cancellations, layoffs, and bad deals. Double Fine had found a fourth option. Kickstarter, a crowdfunding website that had launched in 2009. Using this website, creators could pitch directly to their fans. You give us money, we'll give you something cool. During Kickstarter's first couple of years, users of the site were hobbyists hoping to earn a few thousand dollars to shoot short films or build neat folding tables. In 2011, however, the project started getting bigger, and in February 2012, Double Fine launched a Kickstarter for a point-and-click adventure game called The Double Fine Adventure. Double Fine would release this game as Broken Age in 2015, following a painful 3-year development cycle that the studio documented in a series of excellent short films. It shattered every record. Previous Kickstarters had been lucky to break 6 figures. Double Fine raised $1 million in 24 hours. In March 2012, just as Microsoft was canceling Stormlands, Double Fine's Kickstarter concluded, having raised over $3.3 million from 87,142 backers. No other crowdfunded video game had earned even a tenth of that. By then, Obsidian staff were all paying attention. With Kickstarter, a developer wouldn't have to rely on any other companies. Independent studios wouldn't have to sign away the rights to their intellectual properties or give up royalties to big publishers. Instead of pitching to investors or executives, game developers could make a case directly to fans. The more people they could get on board, the more money they'd make. The crowdfunding revolution had begun. Back down in Irvine, Fergus Urquhart and Obsidian's other co-owners started talking about their next move. They still had South Park: The Stick of Truth in development, but they knew that wasn't enough. If South Park ran into more trouble, or if they couldn't find a new project when it was over, the company would simply run out of money. Obsidian needed to diversify. And even after laying off so much of the Stormlands team, the studio still had 24 developers who needed work. Thanks to the Double Fine Adventure and other high-profile projects, the Kickstarter bug had spread throughout Obsidian. Several employees were high on the idea of crowdfunding, including 2 top veterans, Adam Brennecke and Josh Sawyer. Both had worked on Stormlands, Brennecke as a programmer, Sawyer as the director, and both thought that Kickstarter would be the perfect fit for a work-for-hire studio like theirs. During meetings, as management tried to figure out the company's next step, Brennecke and Sawyer kept bringing up the Double Fine Adventure. If Tim Schafer could make $3.3 million, why couldn't they? Urquhart shut them down. He saw crowdfunding as a desperation move. He thought there was a strong likelihood that they'd flop, that they'd be embarrassed, that nobody would give them a dollar. "Even if you feel like you have the greatest idea," said Urquhart, "and you really believe in it, and you would put money into it, you still wonder if anybody's going to be there." Instead, he asked Sawyer, Brennecke, and the remaining Stormlands developers to start putting together pitches for outside investors and publishers. As spring turned into summer, Obsidian offered its services to almost every big publisher in gaming. The studio's leadership talked to Ubisoft and Activision about doing big series like Might and Magic and Skylanders. They spent some time pitching and briefly working on their own version of Bethesda's ill-fated Prey 2. Originally developed by the Wisconsin-based Human Head Studios, the project known as Prey 2 bounced around several times before ultimately getting rebooted by Arkane Studios as Prey, which came out in May 2017. They even took a few of their ideas for Stormlands and transformed them into a new pitch called Fallen that was spearheaded by one of Obsidian's co-owners, Chris Avalon. Fallen would later morph into an RPG called Tyranny, which Obsidian released in November 2016. None of those pitches went anywhere. Big publishers had reasons to be conservative. The Xbox 360, released in 2005, and PlayStation 3, 2006, were near the end of their lifespans, and a new console generation was on the way. But analysts and pundits were predicting that console gaming was doomed thanks to the rise of iPhones and iPads. Publishers didn't want to invest tens of millions of dollars into big games without knowing that people would actually buy the next generation Xbox One and PS4. By June 2012, many at Obsidian were sick of failing. Some had already left the studio, while others were considering calling it quits. Those who weren't making South Park felt like they were stuck in development purgatory, moving from pitch to pitch with no real work in sight. "Nothing was going anywhere," said Brennecke. "Even the pitches we were doing, I don't think anyone was really into." Fergus Urquhart started having breakfast meetings with the company's lawyer to talk about what it might look like if they had to pull the plug, in case they couldn't find another project by the time they'd finished South Park. Then Josh Sawyer and Adam Brennecke came to Urquhart with an ultimatum. They wanted to launch a Kickstarter. They preferred to do it with Obsidian, but if Urquhart continued to stonewall, they'd quit, start their own company, and do it themselves. To sweeten the pot, Sawyer added that he'd be happy to keep working on pitches for publishers as long as someone at the company started planning a Kickstarter. It helped that other Obsidian veterans had also expressed a great deal of interest in crowdfunding, including Chris Avalon, who had been publicly praising Kickstarter for months, even going as far as to poll Obsidian fans about what kind of project they'd want to help fund. Avalon had even partnered with Brian Fargo, the founder of Interplay and a longtime friend of the company, on the Kickstarter for a game called Wasteland 2. Urquhart relented, and within the next few days, Adam Brennecke was locking himself alone in an office, trying to come up with the perfect Kickstarter. One thing became immediately clear to everyone who was left at Obsidian. They needed to make an old-school RPG. Much of the company's DNA came from Black Isle, the studio that Fergus Urquhart had operated back in the Interplay days, which was best known for developing and publishing RPGs like Icewind Dale, Planescape Torment, and Baldur's Gate. These games had several things in common. They were all based on the world and rules of Dungeons & Dragons. They all put a huge focus on story and dialogue, and they all used a fixed, isometric camera that would let you play with an angled perspective, as if you were looking down at a chessboard. Since they all used the same basic technology called the Infinity Engine, they all felt similarly to play. Nobody was making games like that anymore. Isometric RPGs had gone out of favor in the mid-2000s, replaced by games with 3D graphics, voice acting, and far fewer conversations. Publishers were mostly trying to chase mega-hits like The Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, the Bethesda-developed 2011 RPG that had sold over 30 million copies. Gamers had been grumbling about this trend for quite some time. Anyone who'd grown up playing Black Isle's isometric RPGs agreed. Those games were classics, and it was a shame that the game industry had moved past them. Obsidian didn't have the Dungeons & Dragons license, so they couldn't blast magic missiles or sojourn in the Underdark, but the studio did have several people with experience working on games like Icewind Dale and Baldur's Gate, and they knew that making an isometric RPG would cost far less money than trying to develop a brand new 3D game. If they kept their team small and somehow managed to raise a couple $1 million on Kickstarter, even selling just a few hundred thousand copies could turn Obsidian's fortunes around. Adam Brennecke spent the next 2 months working on a pitch, compiling PowerPoint presentations and spreadsheets in preparation for what they were now calling Project Eternity. He brainstormed with Josh Sawyer, Chris Avalon, and other veterans at Obsidian, including Tim Kaine, a designer best known for his work on the original Fallout. Before they could launch the Kickstarter, they needed to nail down every detail, so they spent weeks mapping out a schedule, a budget, and even reward tiers. "There was a lot of debate," said Brennecke. "Do we have a physical box? What goes in a physical box? Do we do a collector's edition? What items go in the collector's edition?" "You'd get a box by pledging at the $65 tier on Kickstarter," they decided. "For the snazzy limited edition, which came with a cloth map, you'd have to pay at least $140. In August, Brennecke sat down with Obsidian's owners and gave them the full pitch. "This would be D&D without the bullshit," he told them. "Project Eternity would take the best parts from those old-school RPGs that everyone loved, but it'd ditch the features that felt obsolete after the last 10 years of innovation in game development." Brennecke told them he'd budgeted for a Kickstarter goal of $1.1 million, but he secretly thought they could hit $2 million. "Obsidian employees want to make this game," he wrote. The owners agreed. They said Brennecke could put a small team together and launch the Kickstarter in September. From there, Brennecke pulled Josh Sawyer away from the dreary world of pitching and asked him to start designing the game. They knew Project Eternity would be set in an original fantasy world, but what would it look like? Brennecke had thought it'd be cool to do something that focused on human souls, so Sawyer riffed on that. In the world of Eternity, souls wouldn't just be metaphysical ideas. They would be tangible sources of power for people. Your main character would be a gifted watcher with the ability to peek into other people's souls and read their memories. "I came up with that sort of concept as, that's what the player character is going to be," said Sawyer. "Where does it go from there? We'll figure it out." You'd start off by customizing your character. You'd pick a class, fighter, paladin, wizard, and so on, a race, traditional fantasy fare like humans and elves, or one of Eternity's original races like the divinely enhanced godlike, and a smattering of skills and spells. Then you'd get to go out into the world of Eora and explore. You could go on side quests, recruit companions, and fight monsters using the gear and weapons you'd acquire along the way. Combat would unfold in real time, but in the vein of classic RPGs, you'd be able to pause at any time to zoom out and figure out a strategy. Like those old games, this one would be on computers only, no consoles. Eternity, as Obsidian envisioned it, would take the best ingredients from Baldur's Gate, Icewind Dale, and Planescape Torment, and put them all together in one delicious stew. For the next few weeks, Adam Brennecke and Josh Sawyer met daily with their small Kickstarter crew. They pored over every word, every screenshot, and every second of their video pitch. They battled against last-minute second-guessing from some of the owners. Was this really a good idea? What if nobody showed up? And on the morning of September 10th, 2012, they launched a teaser countdown on the Obsidian website, promising big news in 4 days. This was finally our chance to sidestep the publisher model and get financing directly from the people who want to play an Obsidian RPG, Chris Avalone wrote in an email to me that week. I'd much rather have the players be my boss and hear their thoughts for what would be fun than people who might be more distant from the process and the genre and, frankly, any long-term attachment to the title. Around the same time, a separate team at Obsidian was working on a pitch for the Russian publisher Mail.ru, one of the largest internet companies in Eastern Europe. Mail.ru had been watching the success of the game World of Tanks, which brought in hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue a year, primarily from fans in Europe and Asia, and the publisher was eager to make its own online tank game. Although multiplayer tank games weren't Obsidian's MO, Obsidian was, as Urquhart liked to say, the dorky RPG guys, the company's owners saw it as an opportunity for a stable stream of income, so they dreamed up what would later be called Armored Warfare. Toward the end of 2012, Armored Warfare would turn into an important financial security blanket for Urquhart and crew. What it meant was that they weren't gambling everything on Kickstarter, just a few things. On Friday, September 14th, 2012, a group of Obsidian employees gathered at Adam Brennecke's desk and hovered behind him, waiting for the clock to hit 10 a.m. They'd run into a scare an hour earlier, when a big red text alert had informed Brennecke that there was an ambiguous problem with the campaign, but a quick call to Kickstarter HQ had resolved the issue just in time. At exactly 10 o'clock, Brennecke hit the launch button. When the page loaded, the ticker was already at $800. How the hell? Brennecke hit refresh. They were over $2,700. Then $5,000. Within a minute, they had broken five digits. If you were to have visited the offices of Obsidian Entertainment on September 14th, 2012, you might not have realized you were at a game development studio. There was very little game development happening there. What you'd have found instead was dozens of people mashing F5 on their keyboards, watching the Project Eternity Kickstarter raise hundreds of dollars per minute. In the afternoon, realizing that they weren't going to get much work done, Fergus Urquhart took a group of staff and went to Dave & Buster's across the street, where they ordered a round of beers and proceeded to stare silently at their phones, refreshing Kickstarter. By the end of the day, they had hit $700,000. The next few weeks were a whirlwind of fundraising, updates, and interviews. Project Eternity raised its original goal of $1.1 million a day after the Kickstarter went live. But Urquhart and his crew weren't content settling for the minimum. They wanted to raise as much as possible. More money wouldn't directly translate to a better game, but it would mean that they could afford to hire more people and take more time on the project, which would probably lead to a better game. As Brennecke scrambled to produce a regular stream of Kickstarter updates, the team began to add stretch goals, features they'd add to the game if they hit certain funding thresholds. It became a tricky balancing act. There was no way to know how much each feature would cost before the game had entered production, so they simply had to estimate. Fergus Urquhart wanted to put a second major city in Eternity, for example, but how could he and his team possibly know how much time it would take to build a second city when they hadn't even started making the first one? So they guessed, promising that if the Kickstarter hit $3.5 million, they would add a second city to the game. On October 16, 2012, the final day of their Kickstarter campaign, the staff of Obsidian held a party to celebrate their success. The whole company gathered in a conference room, much as they had 7 months earlier, when they found that Stormlands had been canceled, and hooked up a camera so they could broadcast their reactions on an internet stream. They drank, sang, and watched the final dollars pour in. When the countdown hit zero, they had raised $3,986,794, nearly four times their Kickstarter goal and double what Adam Brennecke, the most optimistic of the bunch, had hoped they could get. With additional backing they'd received on PayPal and the Obsidian backer website, Their final budget was around $5.3 million. Fulfilling and shipping Kickstarter rewards like t-shirts and portraits would drain hundreds of thousands from that sum, so the actual budget was closer to $4.5 million. Urquhart's company had gambled that fans would show up and pay big for the type of classic RPG that publishers would never fund, and those fans had delivered. In just half a year, thanks to Armored Warfare and Project Eternity, Obsidian's trajectory had reversed. The company was no longer on the edge of collapse. They finally felt free to do what they wanted to do, rather than what a publisher wanted from them. Now, they just had to make a game. A week after the Kickstarter ended, once the dust had settled and the hangovers had eased, Josh Sawyer released a short video update to backers. "The Kickstarter's over," he said. "Thanks. But now, it's time to work." Work, for Sawyer and the rest of the team, meant entering pre-production, the period of development when they'd try to answer fundamental questions about Eternity. They knew they wanted to make a game that felt like Baldur's Gate, but if they couldn't use the Dungeons & Dragons rule set, what would their characters look like? What kind of skills would each class have? How would combat play out? How many quests would be available? How big would the world be? What sort of graphic techniques would the artists use? Who would write the story? How big would their team get? When were they going to release the game? Josh Sawyer, a history buff and an avid cyclist with striking tattoos of poetry running up both arms, had taken the role of project director, the same job he'd had on Stormlands. Colleagues describe him as a director with a strong vision and a tendency to stick to that vision, no matter whom he rubs the wrong way. "Josh, by far, has the highest percentage at making the right decision the first time," said Bobby Null, the lead level designer. 80 or 85% of the time he makes the right call. When he needs to, he'll fight the fight all the way up as far as it needs to go, which is not an easy fight sometimes to have when we're talking about fair amounts of money. In the opposite corner from any of those fights was Adam Brenneke, who took on the dual roles of executive producer and lead programmer. Brenneke, an easygoing soccer player with expressive eyebrows, liked to describe himself as the glue guy, the person in charge of ensuring that Eternity's pieces would all fit together. He was also responsible for the budget. During the first few weeks after the Kickstarter ended, his job was to plan a schedule and figure out exactly how much money the team could spend on each part of the game. It made him a natural foil for Sawyer, who was looking to squeeze in as many ambitious ideas as possible. Early in pre-production, Sawyer stood his ground on big decisions, most significantly the size of the game. The old Infinity Engine games, which the team had been playing during spare afternoons for inspiration, had worlds that were divided into individual map screens, each full of objects and encounters. The largest of these games, Baldur's Gate 2, had nearly 200 unique maps. To plan Project Eternity's scope, Sawyer and Brenneke would need to figure out how many maps the game would have. Brenneke had settled on 120, but Sawyer disagreed. He wanted 150. And Sawyer wouldn't relent, even though they all knew it would cost more money. The way I view the relationship between production and direction is there intentionally should be a little bit of antagonism, Sawyer said. Not hostility, but the director at some level is saying, "I want to do this, I'm writing this check." Production holds the checkbook. Thanks to crowdfunding, Brenneke had over $4 million in that checkbook, which was a lot of money for a Kickstarter project. But compared with modern major video game budgets, which can cap out at hundreds of millions of dollars, it was minuscule. Using the standard $10,000 per person per month burn rate, the Eternity budget could maybe feed a team of 40 working for 10 months, or a team of 20 working for 20 months. $4 million could even fund a team of 2 people working for 200 months, although Kickstarter backers might not enjoy waiting 17 years for their game. That was all on paper, though. In real life, the math was never that clean. A development team would expand and contract based on what it needed every month, and the budget would adjust accordingly. Brenneke would have to build a living schedule, a schedule that could change at any given day based on how they were doing. In game development, these schedules are always malleable. They have to account for iteration, human error, and the fact that creativity can come and go in bursts. On top of that, said Brenneke, there is an expectation that we will get better and more efficient as we make more and as the development tools get better. The number of maps made a huge difference. Building 150 maps instead of 120 might mean several extra months of work, which would expand the schedule, which would cost Obsidian a lot of money. But Sawyer wouldn't give in. "I think in retrospect, that's why our games are what they are," said Brenneke. making crazy decisions like that, where it's just, we can do it, let's figure it out. As Brennecke and Sawyer battled over Project Eternity's scope, the art team was running into its own set of problems. For years, Obsidian's artists and animators had used a program called Softimage to create 3D graphics, but by 2012 it felt obsolete, lacking pivotal features compared with its competitors. By 2014, it would be discontinued. To modernize, some of Obsidian's owners and Rob Nessler, the art director, decided to switch to Maya, a more popular 3D graphics tool that would work more smoothly with their game's engine, a modified version of Unity. An engine, which we'll discuss more in Chapter 6, is a collection of reusable code that helps developers create games. Unity is a third-party engine that's commonly licensed and used by independent studios. Long-term, Nessler knew this was the right choice, but there would be growing pains. It would take the art team weeks to learn how to properly use Maya, which meant that early production would move far more slowly. People like to say, oh, it's just another software package, you'll learn it, Nessler said. But to really learn how to achieve mastery and competence, to be able to adequately schedule how long it'll take you to do something, you need to get to a level where you're able to problem solve in these packages. It takes time, months or years to become so good at something that when someone says, how long will it take you to do something, you can say, it takes me this long. Without the ability to estimate the length of basic art tasks, the producers couldn't put together an accurate schedule. Without an accurate schedule, they couldn't determine how much money the project would cost. $4 million wouldn't go very far if the team took 6 months to build each map. If they were working with a publisher, they might have been able to renegotiate their contract to eke out more funding. But for Eternity, that wasn't an option. The budget was the budget, said Justin Bell, the audio director. We couldn't go back to the backers and say, give us more money, it just wouldn't look good. So there was very little negotiation room. Because of the switch to Maya, and the art team's lack of experience making isometric RPGs, it took a long time before Eternity's early prototypes started looking right. For a while it was too dark, too muddy, and too different from those old Infinity Engine games. After some heated arguments and long periods of iteration, the art team started to learn that there were certain aesthetic rules they needed to follow for a game like this. They shouldn't have tall grass, for example, because it would hide the selection circles that appeared under Eternity's main characters. Short grass would allow the player to better keep track of his or her party. Another rule, floors had to be as flat as possible. Maps with different levels of elevation were particularly tricky. You'd usually start from the south or west section of a screen and move north or east, so each map had to escalate accordingly. If you walked into a room and there was a set of stairs going upwards to the south, it would feel disorienting, like you just walked into an M.C. Escher painting. In the months following the Kickstarter, the ever-expanding Project Eternity team battled over dozens of these creative decisions, reducing the scope and cutting features as they tried to figure out the optimal way to build each area of the game. For a game, especially with a fun factor, you don't really get it until you start playing and seeing it, said Brennecke. You think, there's something that doesn't feel right. What doesn't feel right about this game? And that's where Josh and I come in and we sit down and we really analyze what is actually wrong with this. After building a few technical prototypes, the team's first major goal was to hit vertical slice, a small chunk of the video game designed to resemble the final product in as many ways as possible. During traditional publisher-funded development, it was important for a vertical slice to look impressive, because if the publisher didn't approve, the studio wouldn't get paid. When you're focusing on a publisher, a lot of the times you'll just do things the wrong way on purpose, said Bobby Null, the lead level designer. It's smoke and mirrors, hacking stuff in and trying to impress the publisher so they'll keep paying the bills. But with Eternity, the team didn't have to fool anyone. The checks were already deposited. They could approach their vertical slice in what they like to call the right way, drawing models and designing areas using the same methods that they would then use to make the final game, which helped save time and money. There was no big publisher demanding progress reports, but Obsidian did feel obligated to offer regular updates to the 74,000 Kickstarter backers who had funded Eternity. The upside of talking to fans was that they could be open and honest without worrying about a publisher's iron-tight PR strategy. The downside was that they had to be open and honest all the time. Every week or two, the Obsidian team would put out a new update filled with details on what they'd been doing, sharing extravagant concept art and snappy chunks of sample dialogue. Some of these updates were incredibly in-depth, including photos of spreadsheets, and extensive explanations of systems like combat and character building. That meant getting instant feedback, which could be tough to handle. You grow a thick skin pretty fast, said Kaz Arriga, a concept artist. Eternity's developers, like most of the people who make games, were used to developing in isolation, getting feedback from the outside world only when they released a new trailer or wandered around a trade show. With a Kickstarter approach, they'd get criticism in real time, which could help make the game better in a way that just hadn't happened on previous projects. Josh Sawyer, who read the Kickstarter backer forums nearly every day, would constantly read and absorb fan feedback, to the point where he scrapped an entire system they'd planned after seeing a backer's compelling explanation for why it shouldn't be in the game. That system, item durability, would have been tedious and boring, Sawyer said. Some backers were outspoken and demanding, even asking for refunds when they didn't like how Eternity was shaping up. Others were energetic, constructive, and supportive. A couple even sent packages to Obsidian full of treats. It was actually really cool, said Darren Monahan, one of Obsidian's co-owners. It felt like we had maybe 300 or 400 other people working on the game who weren't really working on the game. Toward the middle of 2013, the Eternity team finished the vertical slice and shifted from pre-production to production, the phase in which they would build the bulk of the game. The artists had grown familiar with the tools and pipelines. Josh Sawyer and the other designers had laid out systems like spellcasting and crafting, and the programmers had finished up fundamental features like movement, combat, and inventory management. The level designers had built outlines and sketches for most of the areas, but the game was still very much behind schedule. The biggest problem was Project Eternity's story, which was coming together far more slowly than anyone on the team had expected. Sawyer and Brennecke had entrusted the main narrative to Eric Fenstermaker, a writer who had been at Obsidian since 2005. What made things complicated was that Fenstermaker was also the lead narrative designer on South Park, The Stick of Truth, a game that was going through a publisher change and its own development hurdles. Eternity was shipping later, so South Park became the priority. Fenstermaker had come up with some high-level ideas for Eternity, and the team had already established a lot of the background lore, but it was clear they needed help to finish all of the story and dialogue. In November 2013, the team brought in Carrie Patel, a published novelist with no previous video game experience, to be Eternity's first full-time writer. Narrative being a little late to the party was a challenge, Patel said. The way the story was assembled was there were a bunch of treatments put together by different people in pre-production, and the result was trying to take the best of all of those and assemble them into a story. It created some challenges that we might not have had if we said, let's just write the story and figure it out. Patel found the transition to video games fascinating. Writing a video game was a totally different experience than writing a novel, in which a story moved in one linear direction. A game like Eternity would force writers to look at their stories less like roads and more like trees, where different players moved along different branches. Almost every conversation in Eternity allowed players to choose what to say, and the story had to account for each possibility. Late in the game, for example, the player had to decide which of the world's gods to support on their quest to track down the villainous priest Theos. Patel and the rest of the writing team had to dream up dialogue for each deity scenario, knowing that each player might see only one of them. At the end of 2013, Obsidian decided to put out a teaser trailer to give the world a taste of what it had been building. Adam Brennecke sat down and started editing the trailer, while the concept artist Kaz Arriga was tasked with designing the logo. For Arriga, another industry newcomer who had worked on Star Wars cartoons before coming to Eternity, this was a terrifying prospect. He'd been working at Obsidian for less than a year, yet now he had to come up with one of the most important parts of the game. The image that would be plastered across Eternity and all of its marketing materials for years to come. It was grueling. Every day, Arriga would get different bits of feedback from different department leads at Obsidian. Often, these items of feedback would contradict one another, leaving Arriga wondering how he could possibly make everyone happy. I was in the pressure cooker, he said. That was a learning experience. It took more than 100 different sketches before Arriga finally came up with a logo that pleased the whole team. On December 10, 2013, Brandon Adler, the production lead, posted an update on Kickstarter. Through the hard work of the Project Eternity team, we are proud to present our first in-game teaser trailer, he wrote. The trailer zipped between snippets of gameplay to the accompaniment of epic choral chanting. Wizards flung flames at giant spiders. An ogre slammed his hammer down on a party of adventurers. A massive dragon spat fireballs. At the end, Arriga's logo appeared, towering onyx pillars flanking the project's official new name, Pillars of Eternity. People were thrilled. This Pillars of Eternity game looked right out of the early 2000s, resembling Baldur's Gate and all those other old Infinity Engine games that people had missed so much over the past decade, but the graphics were sharper and prettier. "Oh my gosh," wrote one backer. "The indoor scenes look absolutely amazing," wrote another. "And, you know, the outdoor ones, too." Exhilarated at the positive reactions, the Eternity team entered 2014 feeling like the project had momentum, though the workload in front of them was intimidating. Brennecke's schedule had them on track for a November 2014 release, and there was still a great deal of game left to be finished. Even without a fancy 3D world, Pillars of Eternity had grown humongous, thanks mostly to Josh Sawyer's edict that they ship with 150 maps. On many games, once the schedule starts feeling too tight, the producers might look to cut features or areas that don't seem critical. But with Pillars of Eternity, Adam Brennecke had a unique problem. Obsidian had already promised many of those features to fans. During the Kickstarter, the developers had made a big show out of having a huge 15-level optional dungeon that they now had to construct, no matter how many late nights it would take. And then there was that second big city. Obsidian had already finished the first city, Defiance Bay, and it looked fantastic. It was complex, layered, and pivotal to the story. And now, after the developers had gone through the convoluted process of designing and modeling Defiance Bay's various districts, the thought of building a second city was making them all queasy. "Everybody said, 'I wish we hadn't done that,'" said Fergus Urquhart. Ultimately, it was not necessary. "Even more districts of the one big city probably would have been easier," said Josh Sawyer. "And pacing-wise, you go through all of Defiance Bay, then you do a bunch of wilderness areas, and here's another city. It's like, dude, this is Act 3. Please get me the fuck out of here." Still, they'd made the commitment. The second city had to be there, and so they built Twin Elms, knowing that if they didn't deliver on every feature they promised in the Kickstarter, fans would feel betrayed. In May 2014, Obsidian had to switch its focus again. It had struck a deal with the game publisher Paradox to help out with PR and marketing, and as part of that deal, the team had to go to E3, an annual video game trade show where developers converge to show off their hot new projects. Having a presence at gaming's annual Mecca would be huge for Pillars of Eternity, but it also meant the team would have to spend weeks working on a demo that was functional and polished enough to pass for the final game. The team's leaders decided to limit their E3 demo to closed-door sessions, with Obsidian's developers controlling the mouse rather than put it on the show floor for everyone to play. This way, there'd be no risk of players running into bugs or crashes if they clicked on the wrong thing. Adam Brennecke also decided that the demo would comprise a chunk of the game that they needed to work on anyway. "My policy for E3 and for Vertical Slice is it has to be something that's going to ship in the game, so the work is not wasted," said Brennecke. "I've been on a lot of projects where you do an E3 demo that has nothing to do with the game. We think, why are we doing this? It's such a waste of time." Brennecke determined that they'd show off the first half hour of the game, in which the main character of Pillars of Eternity is traveling through a forest with a caravan of strangers. Enemies ambush the caravan, and the protagonist is sent fleeing through a nearby maze of caves, where he or she defeats monsters, darts through traps, and stumbles upon a group of cultists performing a disturbing ritual. The section had some story, some combat, and a cliffhanger ending. In other words, it was the perfect demo. "I said, let's just polish the shit out of it," Brennecke said. "None of this time is going to be wasted at all. It's the beginning of the game that needs the most polish, so let's polish the crap out of it." Polish, in video game parlance, generally refers to bug fixing, fine-tuning, and all the other fiddly little acts that make games feel smooth and fun to play. When E3 rolled around, Brennecke and crew spent 3 straight days in a small, hot booth, repeating a series of scripted talking points every half hour to groups of journalists. The monotony paid off with great press coverage. Reporters, especially those who had played and loved the likes of Baldur's Gate, were immediately sold on Pillars of Eternity's potential. Wrote one previewer on the website PC World, "I have no doubt this game will be great, provided Obsidian can avoid its typical pitfalls, bugs, terminated quest lines, etc." After E3, the Pillars team had to build yet another big public version of the game, the Backer Beta. Brennecke and Sawyer wanted to make Pillars of Eternity playable to the public at Gamescom, a German trade show where tens of thousands of European gamers gathered every year. They thought it might be unfair to let Gamescom attendees play the game before the people who had funded it, so the Pillars team decided they'd give the demo to their Kickstarter backers at the same time. That meant they had a hard deadline, August 18th, 2014. The 2 months after E3 were a haze of long hours, crunch time, as the team spent evening after evening at the office, trying to finish up everything they needed for the backer beta. As August 18th drew closer, Adam Brennecke realized that the game wasn't in great shape, and sure enough, when Obsidian